This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy, we'll be hearing highlights from our censorship and surveillance series.
What is going to be seen as acceptable speech and acceptable political practice remains to be seen, because we are entering a new totalitarian era.
We'll hear from Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace and Black Agenda Report.
Now you go and see that there's yet another organization, another journalist, another group being deplatformed by these big tech companies. And the bigger question is, how did these big tech private for-profit businesses get control of the public sphere in the first place?
Also, a conversation with Mickey Huff, director of Project Censored.
We're talking about bulk influence through mass individual targeting of individual psychology, which has been collected by these giant new AI organizations. So the end result means that humanity will not be able to detect what is happening to humanity, because the lies, if you like, or the influence attempts are so fast and so sophisticated.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and more. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Many Americans applauded when Twitter suspended President Donald Trump's Twitter account, but others warned that domestic militarism, high-tech censorship, and surveillance are increasing rapidly. COVID, Race, and Democracy spoke to Black Agenda Report columnist Ajamu Baraka. Neoliberal militarists are comparing the Capitol riot to 9/11 and using it to justify the further militarization of Washington, D.C. and Biden's domestic terrorism bill. At the same time, Biden has appointed infamous militarist Susan Rice to a new position, Director of Domestic Policy. Who do you think will become domestic targets during the Biden-Harris year?
Anybody who's involved in oppositional politics, including those elements that are part of the Black Lives Matter movement, but anyone else who questions U.S. colonial policies, who will advance sharp analysis of the capitalist state, who would question some of the dominant ideals, who would suggest that maybe even the police forces should be withdrawn from certain neighborhoods, who would advocate better relations with U.S. so-called adversaries like the Chinese and the Russians. So it's no telling, because what is going to be seen as acceptable speech and acceptable political practice remains to be seen, because we are entering a new totalitarian era. So I think anybody who is in an opposition to the hegemony of the neoliberal project at some point over the next few years are going to experience the heavy hand of the state. Let me just say this about the state. We've been talking about the censorship coming from these private entities, the big tech, Twitter, Facebook, Google, etc., YouTube. We need to make a correction. These entities are, of course, private, but the essence of neoliberalism is the spinning off of elements of the state that are public to private entities. So what we have with these big tech companies is, in fact, the spinning off of the function of speech monitoring and massive surveillance to these private companies. So these companies are, in fact, from my point of view, part of the ideological state apparatus. They are part of the state, just like the private corporate media is part of the state. So we have to expand our understanding of what we refer to as the state.
Yesterday, I signed a petition to Twitter to restore @RealDonaldTrump. The Twitter account of the 45th President of the United States. I didn't share the petition on my social media pages because I didn't want to have to fend off a lot of cancel culture, but I still have enough faith in Pacifica to think I won't get kicked off the air for saying this. What do you think of Twitter's suspension of Trump and 70,000 more accounts that they said were linked to the QAnon conspiracy theory?
I think it's quite troubling, Anne. I understand the disgust, the revulsion people have to Donald Trump. We know who Donald Trump is. He's a sociopath. He's a white supremacist. But Donald Trump is, in fact, America. Donald Trump represents the kind of attitude and the kinds of values that made the U.S. settler state what it is today. So this notion on the part of some liberals that he is some kind of aberration is completely ridiculous. It's, in fact, it's ahistorical. But because of the disgust and because of the very serious legitimation crisis the U.S. is facing and the concern that neoliberal politicians have with the possibility of a return of Donald Trump, they have used the incident on January 6th as their opportunity to not only target Donald Trump as a person, but to target his movement. And I use that in quotations. To undermine a above-ground legal political tendency, a tendency that generated 75 million votes. If they can move against Donald Trump and make a connection between some of his speech and what occurred on January the 6th in order to justify a permanent ban of someone who was the president of the United States with 88 million followers, and then decide arbitrarily that because of the conspiratorial nature of these other accounts, they will be taken down also, and people are cheering because they hate Donald Trump. I think what we're seeing is a monumental mistake being made on the part of liberals who think that this state is their friend and that this state will get rid of Donald Trump, but somehow will be able to maintain a commitment to so-called civil liberties. No, they are conditioning the public to accept the constraints of civil liberties, to have faith in private capitalist entities to determine what is acceptable speech and information that can be disseminated. And they are, in essence, and I believe, setting up the kind of dystopia that we see in science fiction movies, where you have corporate interests that have a complete and total control over every aspect of our lives. And of course, complete and total control over the ideals that are disseminated in those kinds of totalitarian societies. So this is a quite troubling move, and even more troubling by the fact that so many people don't recognize its danger. But it's quite slick. Because like you said, why you don't want to share your petition because people would go crazy if you said in public that you believe that Donald Trump's rights have been violated. So this is a quite dangerous moment because what we see, and in my opinion, is the hegemony of irrationality.
In the 48 hours since Biden became president, Israel bombed Syria, killing a family of four. A U.S. convoy of trucks crossed into Syria to steal oil, yet again. A double suicide bombing in Baghdad killed 32 people. And Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations, published a piece with the headline, quote, "The Myth of a Responsible Withdrawal from Afghanistan," unquote, which said, quote, "The Biden administration should accept that there is no feasible middle way for a responsible withdrawal." Unquote. What do you think is next?
The continuation of policies that have resulted in the U.S. being bogged down in Afghanistan for two decades. Policies that will ensure that the wars that the U.S. is involved in will continue. That there will be a continuation of the commitment to U.S. global full spectrum dominance. In other words, war and violence is still at the center of the neoliberal project, and they intend to reintroduce that instrument under the Biden administration. You know, there were reports and leading up to the election that the Democrat Party associated elements were secretly suggesting to the Afghan authorities that they would not have to worry about a peace process being executed once Joe Biden came to power. And they made that argument using some of the same terms and framework that we saw in that article in Foreign Affairs, that the U.S. had a responsibility to remain in Afghanistan. And so they were fully prepared to undermine whatever progress was made toward extracting U.S. forces from that territory. So we're not surprised. We see the kind of elements that Biden has brought into his administration. And these are the elements that were part of the Obama administration. And all of these elements are committed to the U.S. national security strategy, which is committed to attempting to maintain U.S. global hegemony using the instrument that they believe they are dependent on now, which is, in fact, global violence.
That was Ajamu Baraka, Black Agenda Report columnist and founder of the Black Alliance for Peace. A longer conversation with him on this subject will be published in this week's Black Agenda Report at blackagendareport.com.
Don't say words you're gonna regret.
That was Eye in the Sky by the Alan Parsons Project. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Next, a conversation with Mickey Huff, Diablo Valley Community College professor and director of Project Censored. Mickey Huff, what has been the fate of your Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas held last fall and then, as I understand it, disappeared from the YouTube?
Indeed, it did. And thanks for having me on to discuss these issues. The Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas, the lead organizer for that is Dr. Nolan Higdon, whom I've worked with for years on various things. And Project Censored was a co-sponsor of this event. It was also co-sponsored by several academic institutions. This is an ongoing issue. This is an issue of big tech gatekeeping, algorithmic censorship. We have not been able to get any real feedback from YouTube about what happened, except that they, in true Orwellian fashion, they flipped the script and basically tried to say that Nolan didn't upload the videos or that the videos maybe didn't exist in the first place. They were able to find one of the videos, the keynote, and the more irony there is that one of the keynote presenters was scholar Dr. Safiya Noble, who wrote a book a couple years ago called Algorithms of Oppression about YouTube censorship and deplatforming, particularly of BIPOC communities. And we at Project Censored have covered YouTube algorithmic censorship of LGBTQI communities. That was actually in our Censored 2020 book. Andy Lee Roth and April Anderson wrote a whole chapter on Stonewalled, and they wrote another piece for Index on Censorship. We've been on this case for a while, only to interestingly find ourselves at the receiving end of big tech censorship last fall. This is a specific channel that was only set up for the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas. While there might be a few targets on the right that are censored, they mostly always come after the left. Just recently, Greg Palast is talking about consortium news being censored by YouTube. It's almost every day of the week now you go and see that there's yet another organization, another journalist, another group being deplatformed by these big tech companies. And the bigger question is, how do these big tech private for-profit businesses get control of the public sphere in the first place? Right? That's our big concern at Project Censored, is in a proprietary way, these companies, unfortunately, do have the right to censor content or curate content. But that's beside the point overall, given that now these companies, half a dozen or so huge tech companies, now have control over many of these internet platforms where most people are going not only to get news and information, but also to get their messages out. And we think that that's a huge problem that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, on Twitter yesterday, that was the first place I heard that Biden was bombing Syria again. And that's true for many people. But what I was impressed with in what you said was that Google actually talked to you. I don't know anyone who's had any success contesting. Even if you haven't had success, they talk to you and you have a record of the exchange.
I did not. Nolan had a hard time getting a hold of anybody over at Alphabet, Google, YouTube conglomerate. And Alan McLeod was actually able to get in touch with somebody over there. We don't know who, but it was a person. And again, they feigned ignorance, basically. This kind of online censorship, deplatforming, demonetization, and so on from these private big tech companies that all got started with public money. Don't forget that. They all get public subsidies, public monies. They're run amok. And we need a reckoning here. We need to stop this before it becomes even more commonplace than it already is.
Some Democratic pundits and officials have been calling for censorship of Fox News, claiming that they incited the January 6th Capitol riot. What do you think of the call to deplatform Fox News, which seems to mean getting the cable networks to remove it from what they offer?
I think it's idiotic and misguided. I think censorship is not the answer to these problems. The solution or the antidote to speech that we despise or dislike is more speech to counter it. We need to learn how to agree to disagree. We need to learn how to think critically and independently. We need to learn how to keep conversations going, not shut them down. And we need to resist the urge to tribalize our own communications and silo them in an ever social mediated landscape. And I know that's not popular among some crowds, but if you take a look at the people crowing for censorship, they run the gamut. And it's interesting that you can have Congresswoman Green basically claim that she's the poster child for censorship, that she's being silenced. Even though if you take a look, and I read a lot of conservative news sites, and they're all concerned about this, but they think it's only a problem of the, quote, liberal big tech companies censoring them, which is laughable. Because I counter these people with even more examples of people on the progressive left or further left getting marginalized and getting deplatformed, and they don't want to hear it. To them, it's only happening to conservatives. And this is part of the idiocy of the problem. This is about big tech being able to decide which voices are heard. And nobody appointed Zuckerberg or Dorsey as the czar of information. Right. If we have a First Amendment and it means anything, it needs to extend from government to how these big tech companies are basically run by proxy in the public sphere. And that needs to be challenged. So, no, as much as I may dislike and disagree with certain things that happen at Fox News, I'm not wasting my energy calling to deplatform or censor other voices. I try to spend my energy getting people to learn how to communicate more clearly and effectively together and opposing censorship in its many guises.
Would you say you're a free speech absolutist?
I'm not an absolutist about anything except not being an absolutist. So I have nuanced views, but I don't really need to be pigeonholed that way. I think that there are already laws on the books that restrict certain things. There are limitations to free speech. Even if hate speech is a gray or nebulous area, it is an area. Inciting violence is not protected speech. Victimizing people and calling for acts of violence against people is not acceptable or lawful communication. So I don't think we need more laws. I think we need more decent people in power that are able to apply these rules and extend them legislatively to the private sector. I do not think that YouTube or Twitter or Instagram, none of these companies should be allowed to censor on the basis of content. I do realize that when I speak this way, that it may appear that I'm a free speech absolutist, but again, with the caveat that I acknowledge fully that there are clear restrictions to things that people should not necessarily be allowed to say. And those are things where people are inciting violence or leading to things that cause people direct harm.
Before you go, Mickey, I have a question, very quick question.
Yes.
COVID-19. We're being told that science rules and that we're supposed to protect scientific consensus, which changes every week. And when we speak out, let's say, about something that is not in agreement with the CDC currently or with the WHO, then also the algorithms do their thing to us. What do you think about that?
I think it's ridiculous, and it's another form of censorship. I see it as quite pernicious and insidious. I know that these are controversial issues. And again, Alan McLeod at Mint Press News just experienced this with a piece that he wrote about Bill Gates. He wrote a piece about Bill Gates and vaccine rollouts and what the profits benefits were behind it, who was benefiting from it, and which groups were sort of being left in the lurch or left behind. And that piece was demonetized. So algorithmically, he was targeted that way because he was using key terms. But it's as if the algorithms aren't real people and don't bother to read the context of the article, so they don't understand what he's even saying. You know, similarly, I know that this isn't popular at Pacifica, but Robert Kennedy's Children's Health Defense is a resource that uses government documents, CDC documents, WHO documents, public health documents, and peer-reviewed research that's been published to argue about how we can make medical treatments and vaccines safer. They immediately get called anti-vaxxers and flat earthers, which is a propaganda campaign. Kennedy himself is not against vaccines. He is for vaccine safety. That there are some people that will glom onto that and make it sound like he's saying something that he isn't is part of the problem of our propaganda system and a lack of critical thinking and discourse. And it's a lack of tolerance to have these open discussions. Science isn't a thing like scientism. It's not something to be worshipped. Scientific methodology is just that. It's a method of constantly questioning, constantly looking at evidence, and reforming the way we see the world based on transparently sourced evidence. And we can't do that process if we have people and we have powerful institutions trying to shut down people that ask legitimate questions. And I want to be very careful with this, because there is a certain way that legitimacy can be established by transparently sourcing the nature of the questions. And I think that we see that among some people in our society. Are there other people that, you know, use this opportunity to wildly speculate and cast aspersions and say things that are not proven? Yes. Is that a problem? Yes. But we have to be very careful, I think, about how we get to decide who gets a say and who doesn't in the public sphere. Because often, especially in terms of scientific advancement, it's some people that are saying very wildly unpopular things that history proves later to be true or to be right, or to be more accurate than they were given credit for at the time. And I think that's what it means to respect the scientific methodological process. I'm sure listeners out there are going to be calling the stations complaining, pretending that I'm an anti-vax person or something else just because I have the temerity to talk about this in an open way. But I think that there's a lot of other people that share this opinion that are just too afraid to talk about it because they get tagged very quickly with negative labels. And I think that's part of the problem, is our public discourse lacks critical thought, it lacks critical assessment, and it also lacks compassion for people that have different views and different beliefs. And I think that that's a real crisis for all of us as the human species. And so I would hope that we'd be able to develop a communication system that does allow for reasoned questioning and challenges, but at the same time also acknowledges when there is a consensus around certain topics, but one that always leaves the door open for future possibilities. And I think when we really get into the weeds and start trying to micromanage the kinds of questions people ask in the classroom, and we conflate it with opinions they may have out of the classroom, I think we're on a slippery slope toward a more techno-fascist and totalitarian society. I use the term techno-fascism purposely because I think that there is a degree, a shaded degree of that actually happening among these major tech overlords to try to curate discussion and debate, particularly in ways that goes against the capitalist system. And anybody that wants to pretend like Big Pharma isn't deeply interconnected to the capitalist system probably needs to be checked out for being disconnected with reality. So I think that there is room to ask legitimate questions without making blanket statements that all vaccines are bad and all vaccines are good and so forth. For example, in California, you know, a vast majority, 9 of 10 who opposed SB 277 for mandatory vaccination and connected to public education, were only opposed to the mandatory element because they wanted to confirm with their physicians what was best for their families. And 9 of the 10 people that opposed SB 277 actually were pro-vaccine and had their children almost entirely vaccinated, with the exception of 1 or 2 of CDC scheduled shots that were delayed or postponed because of personal health issues. You don't see that kind of nuanced reporting in the corporate press because they're beholden to Big Pharma interests, and because nuance doesn't sell. It's not sexy. The news media has done a horrible job by dividing the country, by splitting people into factions, and it doesn't need to be that way. And I think that education can go a long way to change people's minds. And I don't mean propaganda. I mean further exposing people to transparently sourced facts as evidence for certain positions. And I think it's also important to remember that we should be very careful about demonizing other people's intentions. Most people really do have good intentions or are well-intentioned about the things that they're putting forward. And if we close down avenues of communication, we don't really get an even or fair opportunity to change each other's minds. And we don't get an opportunity to think more critically about ourselves and our own positions in the world. And, you know, again, I know people listening to this may turn this around and claim any number of things that they think about me, but I would challenge them to invite me to a public conversation about it to find out what I actually think about it so that they don't twist and turn it into something for their own agendas.
Okay, listeners, don't cancel Mickey Huff.
Yeah, hopefully not.
Mickey Huff, thank you for speaking to COVID, Race, and Democracy.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Understand me now. Sometimes I feel a little mad, but don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
That was "Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood" by The Animals. During the 2017 Holberg debate titled, quote, "Propaganda, Facts, and Fake News," Julian Assange argued that the news has always been fake.
I think the media is, in general terms, one of the most destructive forces that has ever existed. It has led to nearly every war that we've had, certainly the wars by democracies, all the big wars that you can name, at least in the post-World War II period, and to a degree, even in World War II, were built up, their populations were mobilized on the back of lies, from the Gulf of Tonkin incident to the Iraq War, to the Gulf War. So the average death count per journalist, I did a calculation for US journalists recently, is something like 130 kills per journalist as a result of them not treating their function seriously, which is to provide, well, their supposed or claimed societal function seriously, which is to provide the truth, and instead spreading propaganda and lies of the major power establishments in the countries that they're in. So I want to, first of all, ground this debate about fake news with the reality that the news has always been fake. It has always been something that has been used to manipulate human populations en masse into absolutely disastrous outcomes in order for proprietors of news organizations to, yes, make profits by peddling salacious stories, but much more significantly, to keep their integration with existing establishments in those countries and at a social level for each journalist and editor to ingratiate themselves socially with the very establishments they are meant to be policing. The renewed talk about fake news, well, it's been taken up by Donald Trump in his critiques of CNN, for example. Okay, now, is it true that those responses by Donald Trump are motivated by a president in power trying to distract from critique of the press? Absolutely. Of course, that's the motivation. But is he nonetheless, in general terms, correct? Yes, in general terms, he is correct. CNN, I don't mean to pick on it unnecessarily. It's certainly not the only one. All the big establishment media in the United States, Fox News, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, are filled every day with very serious and misleading fake news. Why is the term being popularized other than politicians and other people who are criticized in the media using it to rebuff that criticism, whether that criticism is true or, as it very often is, false. Well, the US election, principally last year, saw an outbreak of uncontrolled popularism. Now, that popularism was harnessed by what is effectively neo-fascistic cultural sentiments. That's true. It was harnessed in various ways by those groups. But nonetheless, it is a democratic outburst that occurred principally because of the increased ease with which human beings can share information with each other, social media, small publishers, etc. And that, of course, has led to cultural change, not simply because of underpinning reasons which many people on the left talk about, such as the decline in US real wages from 1978, or by the concerns that people on the right talk about, for example, increased immigration, but rather because the establishment press is integrated with the existing order of things and is used to, has been used to create that order and to maintain it. Now, whether you see a decrease in the existing order as a positive or a negative depends on where you think that is going and whether you stand to lose or gain in the process of that change. Let's do a little thought experiment. Do we accept that the press has a serious influence on society and the ideas that are passed around? We all know that the press has been used to mobilize nations for illegal wars, for example. In democracy, especially, the press is one of the principal controlling functions of the existing establishment, the existing order of things. So when that control structure can be worked around, social media, new publishers starting up with very little capital because of the internet, is that going to change the existing order of things? Obviously, if your claim was that the press is intimately part of the existing order of things, and there's a new press which is not part of the existing order of things, then obviously the order, the cultural order, and to some degree clearly the relative balance of who has power and who does not is going to change. So this has terribly frightened existing establishments, and those existing establishments, of course, integrated with the establishment press by definition. So why we see such talk in the establishment press about the fear of fake news is not simply because it's another thing to be salacious about. Change in the informational control system, of which the existing establishment press was a major component, leads to a decrease in power of the existing establishment and a decrease in power of the existing establishment press. So all those little publishers, social media, etc., are both in some sense direct rivals for establishment press power. So the existing establishments, including, of course, the press, which is integrated with them, see this uncontrolled phenomenon as a direct threat to their power and also to the existing order, which creates fear in themselves and also directly for the press itself. So the press talks about it a lot and tries to push forwards for there to be greater controls in the spreading of information. And this has then led to a very serious situation, extremely serious situation, where pressure has been applied to Facebook, Google, these giant new digital superstates, these giant intermediaries, to regain control of the informational flow system of the West, broadly speaking.
This seems to be very essential to the topic of manipulation of information. You touched on the topic of artificial intelligence. With reference to Facebook's and Twitter's involvement in the last presidential election in France, you said earlier this year, quote, imagine a Daily Mail run by essentially artificial intelligence. What does that look like when there's only the Daily Mail worldwide? That's what Facebook and Twitter will shift into, end quotes. So could you explore that a little bit more? How big is this threat and what can be done about the risks associated with artificial intelligence in terms of manipulation of information and propaganda?
It's overwhelmingly the biggest threat to humanity. It's a much bigger threat than climate change. Artificial intelligence means, look, I've met some very savvy pathological liars, psychopaths. Very, very clever and hard to discern. I'm sure all of you have met one or two of those types of people. Just imagine their capacity to lie and deceive multiplied by 1,000. It's not something that human beings can detect when it is at a certain level of proficiency. So human beings for the last 15, 20 years, we have been documenting ourselves with billions of hours of video uploaded to YouTube with all the thoughts and expressions that we have put on web pages and photo sharing, all the things that we have been searching for, and the photos taken by Google Maps as it drives around streets, our current locations, which is communicated by smartphones, etc. An extremely rich, multivariable description of most of humanity, or at least that part which has any influence on the world. Very, very rich description. That is being used to train artificial intelligence systems. In fact, Silicon Valley, those people who are interested in this type of thing, we've kind of had a model of how it works, what form of capitalism it is. It's surveillance capitalism. Its business is to create so-called free services, bait, if you like your Google search engine, or the free software that Google puts onto Android phones, which power 80% of the smartphones worldwide, and use that bait to collect information from people, what you search for example, and then harvest enormous informational resource. In some models, it's a kind of resource extraction. It comes in and scrapes off information from Norway, and other countries, like a giant open cup mine, and collects it in Silicon Valley, and then creates profiles and sells them to advertisers. Yeah, so it's the informational middleman. That's all changing. That model is completely changing. As a result of surveillance capitalism, as a result of harnessing all that information from the world, it's enough to then create and to train artificial intelligences. That's how, for example, Google Translate has been able to come up with 65 language pairs now. And it's getting quite good. It's as good as an average human translator in many cases, and one that can work 24 hours a day, etc. So instead of thinking about Google Translate, think about Google Liar. Instead of simply translating information, it's actually translating this giant repository of how human beings behave into information that can be projected to human beings to cause them to act in particular ways. Google Liar. Now, already that's happening in a more primitive form, which is to adjust the search rankings, for example. Now, as a result of the establishment fears in the United States from this unruly outburst of populism that led to Hillary Clinton not being elected, Google decided to invisibly re-rank nearly all the critical press, the establishment critical press. So both on the right and on the left. So from the World Socialist website, which went down by 60%, to WikiLeaks, which was pushed down by 30%, Intercept pushed down 19%, Counterpunch pushed down about 40%. So that has had an invisible effect on the behavior of human beings, just based on what they're searching for. Similarly, if you go to YouTube and you see some video that's recommended or not, nearly all foreign policy critiques that are uploaded to YouTube have been demonetized as a form of economic censorship. Those producers who were producing content that was critical of US foreign policy, they don't get any money anymore. No money from Google. This is much more insidious than the case of someone producing a finely crafted news story that is fake, such as that WikiLeaks documents are fabricated. That was the number one fake news story in the United States, according to a study by Stanford. That fake news story was produced not by some site in Macedonia, that fake news story was produced by Newsweek, and who were subsequently sued, and they retracted the article. So instead of finely crafted false messaging like that, think at a strategic level. We're talking about bulk influence of human beings, because these giant new digital superstates operate at scale. So you can have bulk influence. But unlike previous efforts at bulk influence, for example, BBC or a national broadcaster coming up with a line and trying to culturally influence the entire population or politically influence the entire population, we're talking about bulk influence through mass individual targeting of individual psychology, which has been collected by these giant new AI organizations. So the end result means that humanity will not be able to detect what is happening to humanity, because the lies, if you like, or the influence attempts are so fast and so sophisticated. So that then leaves us into a position where humanity can't see what is happening to it. And if it can't see what is happening to it, then it can't possibly change what is happening to it. It's a kind of a fake news apocalypse.
That was WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange at the Holberg debate in Oslo in 2017, speaking from Ecuador's London embassy, which was still providing him asylum at the time. Britain's top court recently refused to allow Assange to appeal the decision to extradite him to the U.S. to face espionage charges. The final decision will now go to the U.K. Home Secretary, Priti Patel. And now we'll hear from our secret news reporter, George Carlin.
And the announcer whispering, saying, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the secret news." And the news ticker gets louder and he goes, "Shh," and the ticker lowers. "Here's the secret news. All people are afraid. No one knows what they're doing. Everything is getting worse. Some people deserve to die. Your money is worthless. No one is properly dressed. At least one of your children will disappoint you. The system is rigged. Your house will never be completely clean. All teachers are incompetent. There are people who really dislike you. Nothing is as good as it seems. Things don't last. No one is paying attention. The country is dying. God doesn't care. Shh."
We'll hear from William Binney, former technical director of world military and geopolitical analysis and reporting for the National Security Agency. Binney, who created many of the data collection systems still used by the NSA, left the agency after, he says, it turned from its mission of protecting the U.S. population to controlling it.
For more than 20 years, I've been warning about the drift of democracies towards totalitarian practices and totalitarian state operation. Spying, what they did fundamentally was start, instead of looking and studying people or groups of people who were potentially planning criminal or other kinds of acts like militaries and so on, or governments or drug smugglers, things of that nature, they shifted from that to looking at individuals. So that meant they were collecting everything in the world on everybody they possibly could. Now, as a part of that process, they had to build large storage devices and they centrally stored all this data. And their entire objective was, of course, population control. They may not have openly said that to you or may not have made that very clear to you, but that's been the tradition down through history of population control. Means you have to have knowledge about your population, everyone in it, what they're doing and what they're planning as best you can, so you can manipulate it and control it. And that's exactly what's been going on for more than 20 years. And this I started internally in the U.S. government warning about in 2001. And then after they attacked me because they didn't want anybody knowing about this, even internally in the government, they didn't want the government representatives or senators, or they didn't want it well known that they were doing this. And so they attacked me with the Department of Justice and the FBI, and they fabricated evidence and data against me because they have the data. What that means is they could actually manipulate it in terms of changing it, modifying it to make it look like certain things are occurring. And they'll put that in sworn affidavits, as they did with the Steele dossier and so on. They'll just lie openly to the court. And the problem is this has gotten so bad. In the 90s and that early 2000s, they started pulling in industry and tech industries and so on. And eventually they got them co-opted in. And now they're just really one big community of data acquisition and data storage and data study on every individual in the United States and around the world. If you are familiar with the movie Minority Report, where they had psychics that were determining in advance what people were going to do, well, this is really what their objective was. And these big tech companies sell all the data they collect to the government for a profit. And so they're making money off of you just for the work you do. You put the data in the base, you respond to things, you say you like this, you like that, or whatever. And all that information is collected together and it characterizes you as a person as to what you think, how you feel, the things you like, and the things you like to do. What that has done, and you've seen it in this past few years, with the Trump administration about how they are trying to manipulate and control the voting. And they do that simply by manipulating what is available for people to see. When you make a query, if they stack the query in such a way that the information that they don't want you to see is at the bottom, and the data they want you to see, which conveys the concept that they want everybody to believe, why, then that shows up at the top. And they, unfortunately, returns so many returns. You get so many options to look at, you never make it through to the point where you can see the things you might have really wanted to see. And so what they're doing is stacking the deck on controlling the narrative so they control what you see and therefore what you begin to think about and the things that you feel exist in the society and how you should deal with them. That's fundamentally the problem with the big techs. I mean, you can see it even now with the shadow blocking. They'll shadow block people who they don't want to have the data seen or see their data, or they will just simply bar them and throw them out of their product. And so they can't communicate using it. Like, for example, President Trump, he had over 80 million followers on Twitter and they threw him off Twitter. I mean, that shows you the arrogance of these people. They obviously are convinced that they will be exempt from antitrust laws and prosecution under antitrust laws with the new administration coming in. So that's the reason they felt they could do these kinds of things and get away with it, because they expect to be protected. And that's that incestuous relationship between government and these tech companies that is playing out. That's how it's turning out. They're planning on controlling the narrative and making sure that people cannot exercise their First Amendment right that way, because they simply bar them from being able to communicate. That's why the antitrust laws first came into being, to stop monopolies from destroying any potential competition. That's what they did to Parler. When people started to migrate to Parler, they shut Parler down. They had to, because otherwise they would lose control. And that's what they really wanted. And unless we can turn this around and have a way to keep getting an informed public, an informed electorate, where people know what's going on and they have the opportunity to see all points of view and then make up their own minds, Then we have truly a republic. As Ben Franklin said, we'll have a republic if we can keep it. And that's really the issue now, is can we keep it? And with the current setup, the way these tech companies are operating, they believe that they know better. Whatever we think doesn't matter. They'll filter us out. They'll chop us off. They'll stop us from communicating so we can't share our thoughts or our ideas or opinions or anything. And that's a total violation. They're scrapping as a constitution. That doesn't matter anymore. When all the crimes that are visible from Washington, D.C. on television, you can see these people committing these crimes and saying, well, we'll let them get away with it because they're part of the us. And so I kept referring to the Department of the DOJ as, I called it, the Department of Just Us. In other words, we, the people of the United States, are not part of it. So we don't have the set of rules or laws that they have. They have a special set which they never get prosecuted. If you notice, no one has been prosecuted for all the crimes they're committing, like lying to the FISA court, all of that. That never happens. And what happens to the telecommunications company for all the constitutional violations of the rights of U.S. citizens? They get retroactive immunity from the Congress. Why? Because they've committed so many crimes that if they were ever prosecuted, they'd be out of business. So they had to be protected. And that's essentially what's going to be happening here. These people feel, these tech companies feel, that they are so powerful now with the new regime coming in Washington that they will be exempt from any laws. All the antitrust laws won't be used against them, and we can just watch and see. It's not going to happen. Nobody's going to get prosecuted. Why? Because it's the Department of Justice.
That was former NSA Technical Director William Binney. He is now engaged in the development of Panquake, a social media platform without the censorship and surveillance controls of the high-tech monopolies. To learn about Panquake, see pan_quake.com. More and more workers are forced to keep up a brutal pace and or take great risk to comply with algorithmically determined production schedules and, for drivers, routes.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy, and we're talking with Adrienne Williams, an organizer and activist with Amazon. She fought for women workers and fought for better conditions, COVID health and safety conditions at Amazon. So welcome to our show.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is that as a driver, you're not aware of the algorithms and you're not aware of how they're being used. So you never know. You're not aware of what your route is. You're not aware of what the expectation is on a daily basis. So to put it in perspective, if you think of a FedEx or UPS worker, they have a set route every day. They know their neighborhood. They know the route. They're able to troubleshoot if they know, like, okay, I know that these roads or these conditions are tough in a certain area. They're able to figure out ways in which to get around things or troubleshoot things. Amazon, you never know what you're going to come up against. And so you're never able to troubleshoot conditions or areas or neighborhoods. And so it makes it really dangerous, scary, difficult. And so I think that's the hardest part, because you can have, for instance, since there's no route designers in your region or your warehouse, all the route designers are in Seattle and they're not aware of your area. For instance, I could be put in the Sonoma Mountains at 9 p.m. in November during a storm. Now, if anybody knows that area, you know there are no actual roads, there are no lights, and those vans are humongous. So you potentially could just fall off a cliff. And if we had the ability to know those areas, you could plan your route accordingly and say, hey, I'm going to do that in the daytime where I can see and it would be safe. Or if they could plan a route, let's say, at Christmas time, and we were in neighborhoods that were a little sketchier, and we knew for a fact that people were getting robbed, they would put us in those neighborhoods again at Christmas time at 10 p.m. And we would tell our dispatchers, like, hey, we've been told by neighbors that people are getting robbed at gunpoint. And they could maybe put us to an Amazon locker instead of going straight to home. But they weren't willing to do that. And so in order to troubleshoot those things, if we were able to take control of our route instead of an algorithm, it would be safer and actually more cost effective, because you wouldn't be losing packages, you wouldn't be losing lives, but if you let an algorithm take control instead of a person. Because here's the other thing about the algorithm. If I deliver, let's say I have 120 homes that I deliver to on a Tuesday, and I make that quota in 6 hours. Then Wednesday, they're going to give me 122 homes. Then on Thursday, they're going to give me 124. Then Friday, I'm 126, and it never stops. So in order to keep those quotas, drivers are breaking the speed limit. There's sensors in those vans. And so the sensors tell the dispatch and then Amazon, because Amazon is aware of everything the drivers do, the sensors tell Amazon whether you have your seatbelt on or not. So if you don't buckle your seatbelt, you get in trouble and can potentially get fired. But the time that it takes to both buckle and unbuckle your seatbelt at every stop is enough time to have you behind on your route. So every driver that I knew, including myself, and I'm ashamed to say it, would buckle our seatbelts behind our backs and have them buckled behind our backs for the entire route. So we were literally breaking the speed limit and driving without a seatbelt for the entire route, because the time it took to buckle and unbuckle our seatbelt was enough to have us behind.
That was Adrienne Williams, an organizer and activist with Amazon, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Paulina Vasilia and me, Ann Garrison. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.